From bell to bell and post to post.
We got a big battle in front of us, baby. And it's just stopped. So let's get funky like a monkey.
Working the territories on the Northwest Coast.
Who wants to walk with the Elias?
You're listening to Wrestle Central.
Give me a hell yeah.
On Sportsnet 650.
You got journalism for that?
With Justin Morissette.
Hi, Andre. Go hey, my good buddy.
Brenner, you get me. You get the Giant, the only professional wrestler who's still undefeated. And Hulk Hogan, not know one thing. And that's why the people go to know too. And that's why they go to remember. You are the next champion, Hogan.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Hello and welcome to Wrestle Central on Sportsnet 650. My name is Justin Morissette. Excited to be back with you again for another big show this week. And you know, we're going to take a pass this week on the show on talking about the current state of WWE and these empty arena pandemic shows that we've been seeing of late. I have spent all kinds of time and energy pouring my frustrations out with just the callous nature of WWE's cuts to their roster and the way they've tightened up their budget unnecessarily of late. So we're going to pass on that this evening and dive deep into the past. Yes, take a look back at the history of professional wrestling on a couple of different fronts. I have been teasing it for weeks that I will finally find time to talk about Vice's Dark Side of the Ring documentary series that you can watch right now on Crave. It is fantastic. We're finally going to do that tonight, and it's a lengthy chat, so let's get right to it. Pleased to be joined this evening by my guest, who is a renowned wrestling historian. He was a field producer for the HBO documentary on Andre the Giant. He is the voice of Monday Night Raw, the French language voice that is on TVA in Quebec. And his latest book as a co-author, his fourth book, is called The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant. Pat LaProde joins me tonight. And Pat, thank you so much for doing this. I understand it's been a very busy week for you.
Yeah, quite busy. But thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk about the great from the Montreal Wrestling Territory, such as Andre the Giant and Dino Bravo.
Yes, because you were also involved in the Dark Side of the Ring episode that came out this past week on Dino Bravo, which is a story that fascinates me as well, and I look forward to talking about that a little bit later on. But I would imagine this is a significantly different press tour for the book than the last several that you've done, just with the timing of these things coming out at about the same time here.
Yeah, I mean, it's people are looking for stuff to do since they are at home. So reading is one of them. So it's a good thing that the book is coming out right now. But the problem with it is that places like Amazon doesn't carry the is having more trouble carrying the physical version of the book because there's some shipping issues because of the situation right now. Plus, we had the French version of the book that was supposed to be coming out at the same time as the English one, but unfortunately, that has been postponed. So, yeah, not quite the launch that we were looking for, but still, we did a lot of interviews, and there's been a lot of interest for the book, so we're happy about that.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time because I know this must be busy with both things dropping at once and, all the kinds of requests that are being made of you this week. You still were like, oh, yeah, I got no problem staying up until 2 a.m. in Montreal to talk about.
That's usually my time. That's usually my time anyway, so it's really no big deal.
Well, it's much appreciated, and I feel like that kind of voracious appetite for doing media appearances is reflected in the writing of the book as well, that same kind of voracious spirit, because I love the style that you and your writing partner Bertrand de Baer have in just kind of diving into the nitty-gritty. If people are not familiar with your work and the books that you've written in the past, whether that's on the history of wrestling in Montreal, Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, or a deep deeper look at Maurice Vachon. You've written about women's wrestling as well. It is so detail-oriented. You know, this is not just a story of Andre the Giant. It is a story of every place that Andre the Giant ever traveled as a wrestler. You guys just have this endless appetite to dive into these details and follow all these tangents as far as you can, and it makes for a heck of a read, I have to say.
Well, thank you. But I mean, we wanted to make the book, appealing for any kind of reader. So not just the wrestling fan, but also the sports fan who knew about Andre, but never really read about wrestling before. So we wanted to make sure to put everything into context and make sure that if we talk about Andre in Japan, for example, that we're going to talk about what wrestling was in Japan at the time and give a little of historic facts about, you know, wrestling in Japan, the same thing in France, the same thing in Montreal. So it was really important for us because we always place ourselves as if we were reading it ourselves and make sure that we would enjoy reading this book. So the more facts, the more figures, the more historical notes that we can make, we're all about it. We're all about that.
Is that how the book came about in the first place? Because you've obviously written about the history of Montreal wrestling in the past as well, and I would imagine that in going through the era of Montreal wrestling that Andre was involved with, you probably went down a bunch of rabbit holes and came up with all kinds of details about Andre and realized how much more there was to tell there as a story as well.
Actually, no, Justin. The idea came after the HBO documentary that I was involved with. It was in the back of our mind to do something on Andre one day because, you know, there was not one single book done on Andre that was worth of Andre's legendary career. So we wanted to make sure that we come up with something that was debunking all the myths and all the legends and all the tales and making sure that, you know, we would cover every single aspect of Andre's life and career. So when I was involved with the HBO documentary, I had the opportunity to go to France with the crew, meet with Andre's brothers, and, you know, I was able to get a lot of information about Andre. Some of that was, you know, a first to me, some of these information that I'd never learned before. So it really came up after the HBO documentary where we pitched the idea of to our editors, ECW Press, and they were like, yeah, that's the right time to do it. So we got into even more research and dig even deeper to make sure we're not going to miss any important details.
Well, it's funny to me that you would say that it only came about after the Andre doc, because, I mean, this is like one of the largest figures in professional wrestling history, Pat. And I don't mean that ironically in terms of stature. You know, this man is a legend, and yet it seemed like you really needed to prod to get the green light on this one relative to some of the more niche subjects you may have written about in the past.
Yeah, well, the book on Montreal wrestling, we do tackle the Andre the Giant because, you know, he first started in North America in Montreal. But when you do 100 small biographies in a book like this, like Mike Dodge Matches and Screwjobs, you cannot go as much into the details for everyone. You know, we're covering over 100 years of wrestling in the province of Quebec and over 100 people, so you know, it has its limits. So with the documentary, that's where really I was like, oh wow, okay, there's so much more to it. I knew there was so much more to it, but you know, when you're facing the facts, when you're meeting with the people, when you're reading more stuff about him, and you dig a little deeper, well, you can do something really more in depth. And that's what we did with the book.
It's Wrestle Central on Sportsnet 650. My name is Justin Morissette. My guest this evening, Pat LaPrade, an author whose latest book is called The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant. And Pat, the true story is such an important part of the book. You know, you mentioned it there that you've really tried to get behind the myth of this man. And I would imagine that this is probably the hardest possible figure that you could try to demysticize, if that's the right word, because so much of professional wrestling and a figure like Andre is bluster that it's almost impossible to tell where the legend begins and the truth lies. And I would imagine that there's a good many truths in the legend and a good many legends in the truth as well.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that, because it's kind of tricky, you know, because all those myths and legends and tales contributed to Andre's, legendary status. But at the same time, you want that there are so many of them, and so many false, statements have been told over the years, that we wanted to make sure that once and for all we would have the most comprehensive and true story of Andre the Giant. So yeah, we do debunk many of those tales, but not only we debunk them, but we make sure to come up with why such story came to be told, to be written, and what is the truth now that we were telling you that it's not what really happened. So we wanted to make sure that not only the reader would find the truth, but would also find why these were made. And you know what? The most funny thing is that most of them were actually told by Andre himself. It was an era where kayfabe was a lot more present. You know, the secrets of wrestling. Every wrestler needed to not only protect the business, but also protect their own characters. And most of that was Andre protecting his own backstory and whatever was told about him. He was just say the same thing. So it was a different era, but I just found that it was amusing to realize that Andre was, one of the perpetrators of those tales,
Yeah, there's almost a contradiction in his life a little bit, in that he seems like he longs to have privacy and to be able to live a normal life on some level, and at the same time he's the one who's leaning into all of these aggrandizements and mistruths and legends about him as well. There's this split between kind of embracing the show at every aspect and also wanting to hide from it as well.
I'm not sure he really wanted to hide from the show, but that came really later in life, where he wasn't so much pain that it was just harder on his body, on his humor, it was just harder on everything for him to just wake up in the morning and do what he had to do. But once he was in a wrestling locker room, he forgot everything. That was like a sanctuary for him. That's where he was just seen as a normal human being, and that's why he never wanted to stop. That's why, as late as a few weeks before he passed away, he was still wrestling in Japan, because a wrestling locker room was where he was the most happy. It's not really that he wanted to hide from the show, but it must have been hard on him to be 7 foot tall giant known all over the world, and you cannot really go anywhere and you cannot really do anything. He had a daughter that he couldn't bring to Disney, for example, because it would have been just awful for her, So it was a different life for Andre, and something that I think we cannot fully understand, since we were not Andre, we were not 7 foot tall and 450 pounds and you know, known all over the world.
Yeah, well, it seems like one of the biggest troubles that comes up very early in the book is just trying to find shoes that will fit him, because I think it's like 11 years old that he starts to take off size-wise, and just you couldn't find footwear to put on a kid that big.
Yeah, it was a little older than that. It was maybe at 14, 15 that he really started to grow significantly. But, everything, he once said that, you know, nothing was done, nothing was made for him. There was stuff for little people. There was stuff for everybody else, for blind people. To use Andre's word, he said there was stuff for crippled people. There was stuff for everybody. But there was not, you know, nothing was made for him. You know, taking a shower in a hotel room was a tough thing for him because he couldn't really fit in the shower. Everything from eating to getting in a cab. Can you imagine in Japan, in Tokyo, Andre trying to get in the cab? I mean, it's funny just to think of it, but it's not really funny for him, you know. So he was always pointed at. He was always this almost like a circus animal everywhere he was going. That's why that when he was finally arriving to the venue for the matches, well, you know, he could just be with his friends, play some cards, and feel like any other guy that was in the locker room, because, you know, they were treating him like any other wrestlers. So it was a tough life, you know, and that's what we're trying to show in the book, that we're trying to explain what kind of career Andre the Giant had, but also what kind of life Andre Rusinov had. And it was a life where it wasn't easy on him, and the more he got older, the more pain he had, the more drinking, and the more he had to drink to relieve the pain. So it was a hard life on him.
Pat, last summer I had the good fortune of chatting with Braun Strowman over SummerSlam weekend, and one of the things that I talked to him about was, you know, when you look the way that you do, is it a matter of you finding professional wrestling, or does professional wrestling find you? I know you wrote about Andre's entrance into the business. He's discovered on the job site on a farm in his late teen years by a promoter who just happened to be there at the time. If it wasn't for that encounter, do you feel like this was always destined to happen? A guy who looks the way Andre does, there's always going to be someone who will find him somewhere along the line and put him on the path that he ultimately took?
It's tough to say. I mean, there's been a lot of seven-footers and even more than that, you know, never did pro wrestling. Some of them played basketball. Some of them just never did any sports. It's really hard to say. I mean, Andre wasn't watching wrestling when he was a kid. Didn't have TV. He wasn't reading about wrestling in the newspapers. His parents didn't know to read. So I mean, it's not like it was his lifelong dream to, you know, become a pro wrestler. So it's really something that it was a job. It really started as a way to earn money. But he was good at it, and he became quickly a big attraction. So lucky for him. It really works for him.
It's Wrestle Central on Sportsnet 650. My name is Justin Morissette. My guest this week, the author of The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant. It is Pat LaPrade. And Pat, let's talk about that first trip to Japan, because that's where Andre learns that he suffers from acromegaly. And that's what obviously made him a star, is this disorder that affects the hormonal growth within the body. But he opts not to get the surgery to have the tumor in his head removed so that growth will stop. You go over a number of reasons why that might be the case in the book, but one of the ones that jumps out to me, I think, is what you just touched on, which is wrestling was something that you did for money. And if he was to get this surgery, you know, it would let him live a much longer life and probably a much happier life as well. But I get the feeling that in that stage of his life, he just wasn't willing to sit out the time that it might take to recover from something like that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there's actually two periods of time where that surgery could have happened. When he got first aware of the disorder in Japan in 1970, and I gotta believe, Justin, at that time, he was misinformed or he miscomprehended what really could be done for him, because it was in Japan. He didn't speak Japanese. He barely spoke English at the time. So I'm pretty sure that there's some information there that wasn't told or that he didn't really or fully understood. He knew, though, that he wasn't going to live that old, because, you know, a year later when he came to Montreal, or a year and a half later when he came to Montreal, he was already having the talks about, you know, well, I won't see my 60th birthday, and I'm just enjoying life. So he already knew that he had a disease that would probably shorten his time on Earth. But 10 years later, in 1981, when he got that ankle surgery, Dr. Yap told him about the disorder, and that doctor thought that he was the first one to actually acknowledge this to Andre. And by that time, Andre just didn't want to do it, because there's two things he was always saying. First was, God made me that way, I don't want to change it. And the other thing was that he was afraid that he would lose what made him special. And that was, you know, because Andre wasn't just tall. He was also, it was his dimensions, his proportions. He was thick, you know, from the hands to the chest, to the face, to everything. So he thought that he would lose what made him special, when indeed he would have not lost that much of what made him special. So, you know, I just think that at the end of it, by 1981, he just didn't want to do it. But it's still kind of hard to really, really understand his process here. But you know, at the end of the day, that's the decision he took.
Pat, is there one story from the book that jumps out at you? Because you mentioned earlier that when you were working as a producer on the HBO documentary, these stories were coming out that were shocks to you that you'd never heard before. You know, you dispel a lot of the myths around Andre's life in the book, but you also uncover a lot of new myths as well. Is there one in particular that jumps out at you as something that was just amazing that you didn't know before diving into this process?
Well, I mean, that story about acromegaly was something that was never cleared before. Especially with the documentary, the story they took was the one from the doctor, where he said, well, Andre didn't know before 1981. So we knew that he knew before. We just had to find a way to kind of prove it. So by talking to Jackie McCauley, who was Andre's longtime friend, and she was taking care of Andre's ranch with her husband Frenchie, Bernard. He told her that he knew from Japan from 1970. Plus, he had seen another doctor in the Carolinas in the late 70s, and he was told again. So he knew before 1981. So that was probably one of the myths that we wanted to make sure to get right, and to come up with some good arguments for it. I would have to say this one is probably on top of the list.
Although the one for me that I was hoping you would mention, and I don't want to spoil all the surprises of the book.
There's so many, Justin.
Yeah, we could be here all night listing all of them. But my favorite details involves Saddam Hussein. Can you tell that story us, Pat?
Yeah, of course. I mean, before coming to North America, he wrestled in Iraq. Because there was a wrestler who worked for WWE among other names as a General Adnan. I don't know if you remember when Sergeant Slaughter wrestled Hulk Hogan for the WWF championship back in the early 90s.
And he sided with the Iraqis.
Exactly. It was always accompanied by Iron Sheik, who was renamed Colonel Mustafa, and by General Adnan. Well, General Adnan was a former wrestler, and he was from Iraq. So he came back home one day, and he was a childhood friend with Saddam Hussein. That is like 1970 when he got back home. So he started doing those shows, promoting shows in Iraq. And for one of the, I think it was the Army National Day in Iraq, he brought Andre over. Andre, you know, was only working in Europe, and I think he had done Africa by then, and Japan, obviously. So he brought him over to wrestle himself, you know. So it was Adnan against Andre. It was 2 out of 3 falls, and Adnan was supposed to win the first, lose the second, and win the third fall, like you usually do in a 2 out of 3 falls.
Of course.
But before the match, Saddam Hussein made sure to... Saddam was a mark. He didn't know that wrestling was fixed. So he told Adnan that he better win against Andre. If not, you know, Andre would, you know, almost threatening that Andre could be hurt, could be killed maybe, if you would win over Adnan. So Adnan didn't take any chance because he didn't know if Hussein was, if Saddam would understand what a 2 out of 3 falls is. So he changed the booking, beat 2 falls to none. And as soon as the second fall happened, the soldiers there started to shoot in the air, and Andre just got scared because he thought they were shooting at him. So he just ran up the ring and hide almost under the ring. It was like the craziest story. And they did another match a week later, but Saddam wasn't there. And I'm not sure that, you know, you could have find enough money to bring Andre back to Iraq after that.
I love the detail as well that they meet Saddam after the match, and Hussein tells Andre that he needs to lose weight if he's ever going to succeed in wrestling.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. He was now a wrestling critic. You know, he said, "Oh yeah, you better lose weight if you want to be something in this business." Yeah, but there's so many stories. Andre was a great prankster. You know, he loved a good prank. He loved to joke and to put his colleagues and his friends into so many funny situations. And from farting in an elevator and you know, like me, Gene Okerlund said, big man, big fart. And you know, you once even, one of his best friends was Dusty Rhodes. And what, you know, Andre had a weird sense of humor, and he once peed on Dusty's head, and that was funny to him. And Dusty thought it was funny. He was like, "What do you want me to do? It's Andre." So he could get away with so many things, but you know, he was just he enjoyed this so much. I don't think he really enjoyed the traveling because it was really hard on him, like getting on the plane and
even just, I would imagine sitting down on an airplane would be impossible for a guy like that.
But I'm 6'2", and I have trouble going to the washroom in the plane. You know, so can you imagine Andre? I mean, he just couldn't. So it was really, the traveling wasn't really cool for him, but when, you know, once he was getting at the arena, and once he was with his friends, you know, that's what he loved the most, and he was just, you know, the happiest guy, you know, when he was there.
I love that Saddam story because it seems just as mythic and bizarre and surreal as any of the actual, you know, stories about Andre that turn out to not be true. And this one really is. I got a big dumb smile on my face here, Pat, especially the idea of Hussein being a complete mark who doesn't know that it's all fixed. I'm reminded of Donald Trump thinking Vince McMahon had died after his limo blew up on Monday Night.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, I mean, but, and it was before Saddam had some power in Iraq, but it was even before he had more power, you know. So it wasn't even just Saddam that we all heard about 15, 20 years later, you know. So, yeah, that's a great story. There's a lot of stories. I mean, it's more than 400 pages, more than 100 pictures. So, I mean, there is stories for everyone in there.
Absolutely. I strongly recommend the book. He debuts in North America in Montreal, and to me, this is something that is like not as well known in Canadian wrestling maybe as it should be, because maybe I'm just out of the loop, but this was kind of news to me that Canada had been so instrumental in launching Andre into the figure that we know him as today.
Yeah, well, the thing was that the Vachons were good friends with Frank Valois, and Frank Valois was in France a lot at the time. And he had wrestled Andre, he knew about Andre, and he's the one who told the Vachon, you know, Paul and his brother Maurice, if you don't bring him in, you're just, you know, fools. This guy is going to be big. So they brought him to Montreal for Grand Prix Wrestling in June of 1971. And he stayed here for, I want to say, 2 years on and off, you know, in the sense that he was still traveling to Japan. He started doing some territories in the U.S., mainly AWA, and Detroit a little. But he was mainly wrestling in the province of Quebec. That's when he had this legendary feud with Don Leo Jonathan. The first match was dubbed Match of the Century, just a playoff, the fight of the century with Muhammad Ali that happened, I want to say, a few months before, a year before. So it was, you know, that big event at the Montreal Forum where 16,000 people showed up, and the rematch drew 20,000 people, and the third match drew 12,000 people. So, I mean, it was, you know, a series of matches that was legendary, and really what made Andre, he was the talk of the town and the talk of North American wrestling after that. Every promoter wanted to have that match. And that's where, you know, among other things, Vince McMahon Sr. heard about Andre for the first time. So and it's the Vachon's who actually brought him to Vince and made sure that, you know, he would be, because Andre couldn't travel by himself for a lot of reasons, one of them being the English language that he never truly mastered. So they wanted to make sure that Andre would be protected. So when they sent Andre to Vince Sr., there was one of the conditions was that Frank Valois would start traveling with Andre. So that's what they did, you know. I mean, the 2 years he spent here, he became like an adopted son for the province of Quebec because he could speak the language, you know. That's in Montreal and province of Quebec, it's really important. If you're a wrestler and you can speak French, you're ahead of everyone else. And that's why, you know, besides Hulk Hogan, all the popular baby faces in the history of Montreal wrestling has been either from the province of Quebec or from France. Johnny Rougeau, Yvon Robert, Dino Bravo, Edouard Carpentier, and Andre, as he was named here, Jean Ferret. So Andre really connected with the crowd here. He was doing sitcoms, interviews, all the talk shows. He was a giant. Everybody wanted to see him. He was a big attraction because some people didn't even really like wrestling, but they wanted to bring their son or their family to see a real life giant. That adds something to it, you know. So and he came back in 1980 as a co-promoter with Gino Brito and Frank Valois when they started what became International Wrestling. So I mean, in Montreal was always his home away from home. He had an apartment here from 71 to 79 before he actually moved to LRB, North Carolina. And after that, you know, as much as he could come back to Montreal, he would. He always, if you were in the business and you were French speaking, you were friends with Andre automatically. I mean, among his best friends in the business, you will find Rick Martel and Gino Brito and Pat Patterson and French Martin and Ronnie Garvin and all those guys, you know, were speaking French. So Andre was always more comfortable speaking the language than speaking English. So it was something that was really, really important for him. And Montreal always had a special place in his heart.
It's Wrestle Central on Sportsnet 650. I'm Justin Morissette. My guest this week, author Pat LaPrade, whose latest book is The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant. And we're going to put a pin in the Andre talk right now, but when we come back, Pat's going to join me for the entirety of the show, and there's still more to talk about, especially as it pertains to Dino Bravo and Dark Side of the Ring. So don't go anywhere. More Wrestle Central coming your way on Sportsnet 650.
Pick yourself up off the mat. It's time for more Wrestle Central on Sportsnet 650 with Justin Morissette.
That's right, like the man just told you, it is Wrestle Central on Sportsnet 650. My name is Justin Morissette, and we are back for more of my conversation with my guest this week, author Pat LaPrade, whose latest book is about Andre the Giant. He was also a featured guest in this week's episode of Vice's Dark Side of the Ring on Montreal legend Dino Bravo, and that's where we go next. We'll get right back to it. Pat, as you mentioned international wrestling and Dino Bravo, and as we talk about Montreal wrestling stories that maybe aren't as well known across Canada as they should be, I feel like that is the perfect segue into talking about the other big project that you had come out this week, the Dark Side of the Ring episode on the life and death of Dino Bravo, which I've heard you talk about as being a very major pop culture figure in Quebec that people would know, but I don't feel like that currency translates across the country. It's like the way that I might be able to list off, you know, who was premier of British Columbia in the 1990s, but you would have no idea, you know? I feel like the Dino Bravo story should be this pop cultural landmark in the Canadian landscape, and yet, I think there were a lot of people who found out about it for the first time this week.
Yeah, it was something very local, again, because of the French language. Dino was the big years for Dino in Montreal, because he started wrestling in 1970 for, you know, All-Star Wrestling and then Grand Prix Wrestling. But when he came back with International Wrestling in 1981, until his departure to WWF in 1986, that's, you know, where he became this big, huge, you know, baby face, and one of the, you know, most popular wrestlers in Quebec wrestling history. He was charismatic. He was good on the mic. When he was doing a comeback in the ring, you know, he had that fire that you couldn't just sit at home and watch this. You were into Dino, and you wanted, you know, for him to come back and to beat the heel, you know. He was my favorite wrestler growing up. He was our version of Hulk Hogan before probably fans in Montreal knew about Hulk Hogan. So I mean, he was that big. He was known all over the province. He was that big muscle guy that was the most popular wrestler we had here. And I mean, he was an attraction as well. Everywhere he was going throughout the province, but also in Montreal, which is, you know, the biggest city in the province, especially for wrestling. So he was drawing big crowds at the Paul Sauvé Arena every week, but once every month or every other month at the Montreal Forum, he would draw 14, 15, sometimes even 20,000 people at the Montreal Forum with, you know, either mass superstar or wrestling Rick Martel on a Quebec City versus Montreal kind of feud. And then King Tonga, who became Haku in the WWF, another of his big feud. The Great Samu was another one. So, I mean, he was all over the place. He was like, this big champion that everybody loved. And but you're right, it didn't translate it to other parts of Canada because he wasn't really wrestling there. And when he got to the point of working with the WWF, he wasn't booked the same way. He was shortly after his debut turned heel. So it wasn't the same thing. So I get that all the time. Canadian and American people not understanding what we saw in Dino Bravo. But it was so popular, Justin, that when there was a planned match between him and Hulk Hogan in January of 1986, and Vince decided against it because he thought that Dino could have been, you know, would have been more popular than Hogan in Montreal, and he didn't want to put Hogan in that position.
Well, there's problems on both sides there, right, though? Because I would imagine Dino would probably have to lose that match, which wouldn't work too well for him in a hometown show probably either, right?
Well, that's the other thing. That's the other thing. As Jerry Briscoe told me about, he said, we feared that, you know, a riot could have happened. I'm not really sure a riot could have happened, but that's how popular Dino was in Montreal.
And hey, Montreal sports fans, I think, you know, hockey fans in particular, I wouldn't put it past them necessarily. And I know that's
yeah,
rich coming
right.
from Vancouver, but hey, it's true.
Maybe you're right. So I mean, that's just to show you how popular Dino was in Montreal. So, but I do understand that that's not the way people outside of the province of Quebec saw him.
And I feel like you could say this about so many of the Dark Side of the Ring episodes, that, wow, this guy's life is like a movie. But it does really feel like when you go over the details of Dino Bravo, and for those who are not familiar, who have not seen this week's Dark Side of the Ring yet, first of all, it's excellent. I strongly recommend everybody catch up with it. But, you know, this is a guy who got involved with organized crime, meets an untimely death as a result of that. There's all kinds of elements going on here. You know, when you look at the sports figures who get the kind of biopic treatment in Canadian film, it just astonishes me that we have not seen a Dino Bravo movie at this point.
Yeah, perhaps because it's still a cold case, you know, and they never found who actually killed him. Maybe that's the reason why, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, Dino's uncle by marriage was Vic Cotroni, who for the longest time was like the head of the godfather of the mob here in Montreal, and someone known, you know, throughout Canada and the U.S.
And a former wrestler himself as well, which is fascinating.
And a former wrestler himself, you're right. So it wasn't his family, but at the same time, he was never involved in this world before, maybe a year and a half before he got killed. And the reason why it's because Dino was getting let go by the WWF. He had been, you know, making so much money with Vince, and Dino was a big spender. You know, like house, you know, a big house, close to $1 million house, sports cars, and all that. So he had a certain way of life that he wasn't ready to give up. He was a proud Italian. Who would have seen, I don't know, selling the house, he would have seen that as a failure, you know? So he wanted to still provide for his family, for his wife and his young daughter, Claudia, who, by the way, I think, you know, she was the star of the documentary. Claudia was so touching and so good in this. But, I mean, so he wanted to provide for him, and, you know, he didn't want to change his way of life. So he needed to find something else to do that would make him the same amount of money. And when all he did in life is pro wrestling and you don't know how to do anything else, well, the options are limited. And, you know, he started being involved in cigarette smuggling and all that, and, you know, probably did a mistake or two that cost the organization too much money, and he got killed for it, you know? So that's so sad, because, you know, his daughter was only 6 years old, and you know, his wife was coming back to the house with her around midnight, and they found him on his chair, you know, crippled with bullets, you know. So it's a really, really sad story because he was so beloved by everyone. But Dino had a short temper. He wasn't afraid of anybody or, you know, of anything. So, I mean, I never thought he was a good fit for the organized crime world because of that.
Well, there's two things that I want to dive into there with you, Pat. It's Pat yep. LaPrade, the author of The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant. My name's Justin Morissette. You're listening to Wrestle Central on Sportsnet 650. Because I feel like Dino's story is, in a lot of ways, very similar to what a number of athletes go through when they hit retirement. You know, one of the things that we talk a lot about on this station when it comes to hockey players is, you know, you talk to a lot of retired guys about life after hockey and guys not knowing what to do because you've dedicated your entire life to one thing and suddenly it's not there anymore. And I feel like that kind of ties into the Andre book as well, because we were talking about, why wouldn't Andre want to get this surgery? Why wouldn't he, you know, want to elongate his life? And so, like, it just seems to me, and you talked about the locker room being a safe haven for Andre, he didn't want to stop because he didn't know a life at that point other than being a pro wrestler, and he didn't want to have to build one, really. And you know, there's just something extra tragic about it in that light, on top of being, you know, an obvious tragedy for all the reasons that you listed as well.
Yeah, I think Andre, the funny thing is that I do believe that if Andre would have gotten this surgery, that maybe his wrestling career would have ended up at one point. It would have. But I do think that he would have gotten more offers to do movies and stuff, because you got to remember that Andre had done some acting. He was in Princess Bride. That was probably, you know, the biggest movie he's ever been cast for. But he had done also the $6 Million Man. He had done some other stuff. So, I mean, I think that he would have been in better shape to be cast as an actor. And he did love it. He really, really enjoyed doing that, and even when he filmed Princess Bride, it became almost like a locker room to him, because the other actors were treating him like one of their own and didn't really make him feel uncomfortable. So I think he would have had a better future there, but, you know, obviously didn't perhaps see it that way. As far as Dino goes, I mean, it was back in 1993, you know, where, you know, he had a big lifestyle, but it's not like he was sitting on $20 million, you know, like hockey players could be sitting on right now, you know, when someone retires at 35 or 36 years old. So it was a different era as well. Options were maybe more limited, or he didn't see other options for him. And but you know, it's tragic to see to listen to his wife, who's saying, "Well, I told him to sell the house. I didn't need a big house like this." And so I guess he had options, but his pride took over, you know. So yeah, it's really tragic when you think of it.
Well, that's the tragic side of it. The other half of it, there is some comedy to me, Pat, in the idea of this enormously famous figure in Quebec. You know, you describe him as being the Hulk Hogan of Montreal. I'm just trying to imagine a celebrity of that size working as somebody basically shaking down, trying to collect debts for the mob. Everyone would know who this guy is. Like, just, you know, the modern analogy that I can think best is, like, imagine if, like, Shea Weber of the Montreal Canadiens came to your house to shake you down, and how absurd and bizarre that would be.
Yes, Shea Weber would be bizarre, but think of John Cordick, or think of Chris Nyland. Would it feel so bizarre? You know, I mean, it was another era. It was almost 30 years ago. I would have seen a guy like John Cordick or Chris Nyland doing that kind of business, because they were known to be, you know, fighters and tough guys, you know. but at the same time, you know, I don't think Bravo really did collecting for a long time. But he was involved in other stuff. You know, some of them were collecting, but yeah, and so many former wrestlers became security agents. in Quebec. Not maybe guys, you know, are at the level of you know, Bravo, but still, you know, a lot of them were working on strikes. So, you know, you're like, there's a strike and you get French Martin or Paul Leduc or, you know, these guys, Rick Charlin, who were there as security agents to make sure that, you know, everything would go peacefully. So, you know, things like that happen. So to see someone like French Martin on a strike or Dino Bravo collecting money, one is legal, the other one is not. But it could be as surprising, you know.
Absolutely. It's just an incredible life story and, a fantastic documentary that you were probably thoroughly involved with, because you were not just a talking head on this thing, but you were, you know, conducting the French language interviews. And, you know, from what I'm aware of, Pat, this is an episode that was originally being put together for the first season of the show before their order got cut back a little, got pushed back to season two. You were probably working on that documentary for about as long as you were working on this book. Is that correct?
Well, no, because I was mainly involved. I was a consultant on the documentary, but most of it was filmed in 2018, so 2 years ago. And by the time that Vice decided to cut the first season to 6 episodes, there weren't much. I mean, I wasn't doing any of the editing or stuff, you know. So I think there was only one interview that was done after they got the green light for the second season. So most of it was already done 2 years ago. So, but that was my part there. You know, I made sure to put the crew, Evan and Jason, in contact with the right people here in Montreal, to kind of be the bridge between the family and them, especially the daughter Claudia, some of the organized crime journalists that we've seen on the documentary. It was a long time waiting for that documentary. Actually, 2 years. You know, I couldn't wait to. For the world to see it. I'm really, really happy with the end results, and I'm really happy that the feedbacks are so great so far.
Well, Pat, you and I could talk all night. I get the feeling there are just so many stories between these two guys to dig into. But before I let you go, I want to talk about your job that you do every single Monday night, because you are the French voice of the, you know, play-by-play for Monday Night Raw on TVA in Quebec. And it's probably a bit of an interesting job at the moment. You know, we've seen a lot of adjustments in terms of how the broadcasts have worked over the last month and a half or so. So as WWE has done these empty arena shows with no fans, you know, there's a lot more empty space that you have to fill in these situations without crowd noise and that kind of thing. How has that affected your approach to doing the commentary in your job on Monday Night Raw?
Yeah, it's actually on Wednesday nights here. So we have a two days delay. And we only have an hour of Raw here. That's the version we're getting. So it's been, I mean, not too different than what we usually do. Because first of all, we have to translate when we get interviews like promos. We have to translate them. So that's what we're still doing. And during the matches, let's say a match on Raw on the original version will last, I don't know, 15 minutes. Maybe we're going to have a 7 or 9 minute version of the match. So we're getting more high spots. We don't really have time to dig into the storyline like Tom Phillips or Michael Cole can actually do. So it's really a different way of doing commentary on the show. I'm doing this with Kevin Raphael, here in Montreal, who's, you know, we have been working together for almost 3 years now. So, you know, we have the chemistry together. We know where we're going with stuff. So, honestly, crowd or no crowd, it's just the atmosphere is different. But we still have to fill as much stuff, as much time as possible, because that's what we were already doing, because of everything we have to translate, and because of the way the format that we're getting, where, you know, we have a lot of high spots, and we have to always be on and always be ready, because action is going everywhere, because they're keeping, you know, they won't give us the rest hold in the middle of the ring for 30 seconds. You know, that's the part that they will be cutting, because we have no control over the product that we're receiving. It's really WWE who sends the package over. So I really didn't see much different in the way we're working. It's really just a matter of you know, what we hear. You know, it's just different. But it's really not the same when you're watching it. You know, when I watch Raw on Mondays, there's a big difference. I don't see it as big on Wednesday night when we do a commentary.
Well, it's too bad there aren't as many low moments for you to fill with storytelling, because I can tell you from the book that I've read and from the last hour of conversation, you are very, very good at that. Pat LaPrade, author of The Eighth Wonder of the World, The True Story of Andre the Giant, co-author along with Bertrand Hébert. Pat, I'll let you plug the book and your social media and so on, and where people can find it, because I've really enjoyed reading it. It's phenomenal stuff, and I strongly recommend that people check it out.
Thank you so much. People can buy the book online. You can try Amazon.ca, but if it says out of stock, I mean, don't worry about it. It's really just a matter of getting books to Amazon's warehouse. But if it says out of stock, I would suggest Indigo.ca or try ECW Press website, because if you buy the physical book on ECW Press website, you get the ebook for free. So while you're waiting to get your book in the mail, you can actually start reading it with the ebook. So that's a 2-for-1 offer there. That's pretty cool. You can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Pat LaPrade. And go and check the Dino Bravo documentary, as well as the first and second season of Dark Side of the Ring on Crave TV or Vice TV Canada. So, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Well, Pat, I hope you enjoy a bit of a rest here, but I look forward to what you write about next, and you'll have to come back and share stories from your next book as well.
It will be my pleasure, Justin. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. That's our show for the week, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I had a great time putting it together. Thanks so much to Pat LaPrade as well for joining me for the full hour. His book is phenomenal, folks. I cannot recommend it enough. We will be back to do this all over again at the same time. This time next week, Sunday nights, 10 p.m., right here on Sportsnet 650. But before I sign off, I do want to dedicate this episode to the life and memory of Jason Botchford, who passed away 1 year ago today, and without whose mentorship and guidance, I might not be sitting in this chair this evening. So my best to my dearly departed friend. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been Wrestle Central on Vancouver's home of professional wrestling on the radio, Sportsnet 650.